Sometimes you're in a group of people, perhaps around a dinner table or you're at a business meeting or something, and you're all sort of chatting away, you're all giving your opinions, and there's one expert in the room who's a real expert on the subject you're talking about. Maybe in a family situation, he's the older one. I wish I was this person in my household, but not always. But maybe it's the kind of senior one through experience or age or whatever else. But everyone kind of gives their opinions. There's all kind of knockabout. And then there's a sort of pause. And then the person sitting at the head of the table, the expert in the meeting, speaks. And everyone goes, oh, okay. And it's a bit like this in the book of Job right now, where finally God speaks. God has spoken a little bit, of course, at the beginning as he speaks to Satan, but in terms of addressing the situation directly to Job, with Job, that hasn't happened yet. But now God speaks out of the storm, it says. God speaks out of some great experience that Job goes through, of some kind of storm, some kind of tempest, indicating the presence of God, the real presence of God. He speaks. The three friends, you'll remember, have finished accusing him. And Job himself has spoken his final words. And then Elihu, the so-called angry young man, has spoken and given his take. But someone who hasn't spoken on earth, the only one whose voice really does count, now will speak. And he needs to be heard. He needs to be heard by Job. He needs to be heard by us. Job actually does get the audience that he's been asking for. Through this book, he's been asking, God, give me an audience with you. But as he gets the audience, it doesn't turn out in the way that he expected, does it? And the next couple of weeks, we're going to look at what God has to say. So God speaks, and God speaks saying, first of all, who are you, Job, to question me? In a way, that's what he says in the whole couple of chapters that we look at this morning. Who are you, Job, to question me? It's God speaking out of the storm. We don't know how Job heard it, but it's some revelation of the power of God and then some experience of the voice of God. It's direct speech from God to Job. It's not mediated by the word of the Lord through a prophet. It's not a vision he sees, we don't think. It's some direct experience of God speaking to him, a bit like the giving of the law. Job is granted quite intimate access in a way to God here to show how valued he was in many ways. But as God speaks, he says it's going to be tough. You see that as he begins 38. He says, verse 3, brace yourself like a man and I will question you. You know, brace yourself or brace. It's what you get as the, not that anyone does it anymore, but if you fly an aeroplane, and they give the safety announcement, and they say, you know, if you get the warning, if you're about to crash, you sort of bend over and say, brace, and you'll sort of bend over. And what's the point of that? You know, we're going to crash. But maybe it would be useful to brace yourself. Well, God says, Job, brace yourself. Hold on tight. Get ready, because I'm going to speak to you. And you've been asking me loads of questions, but I'm going to ask you some questions, and you're going to have to answer me. It's very interesting that God does ask questions. It's affording Job a great amount of dignity. Of course, God could have just said what he's saying here, could have just declared a number of truths that refute what Job has been saying and thinking, or some of what Job has been saying and thinking. But he doesn't do that. He asks questions, partly to show that Job is still a rational man and needs to think, partly to give dignity to Job, partly to make Job and us think, partly to show that it is in the end God who asks the questions, as we'll see in just a moment. The book uses the covenant name, the Lord, the covenant God, L-O-R-D in capitals. And the Lord says, you're confusing my plans with your faulty knowledge. You're obscuring, you're muddling, you're thinking. I have plans, they are clear. You're making them muddled and confused by your own thoughts and ideas. And what we get in these couple of chapters is a great tour of creation, to admire the descriptions of parts of creation, and for Job to be questioned repeatedly. What do you know about this? Job, realize you're not creator, you're not sovereign, you're not God. But as we work through it, and just like some of the other chapters in Job, we've got to work through it at a reasonable speed, because we've got two chapters to deal with. But as we work through it, and particularly great if you can follow along with it in a Bible in front of you, but as we work through it, you've got to think of it on a couple of levels. It is a description of creation. And at the simplest level, we're seeing that Job is shown that he is not the creator, the originator. But actually, there's another narrative going on as we're working our way, as we're sweeping across all different parts of creation. There's something else being told, which is, you're not the one who's sovereign over good and evil. You're not the one with the wisdom who gives it out here and there, who confounds men's plans with his sovereign power. And that's going on as well. Hopefully we can see that as we work through. So, big chunks, verse 4 through to 15 of chapter 38. Here's a question for Job. Where were you at the beginning of everything? Where were you at the beginning of everything? Verse 4, where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Verse 4 through to 7, he describes the earth like a building. And he says it was a joyful process. There was joy there. So it's just an interesting little kind of side reference. Verse 7, while the morning stars sang together. It's just poetic. I don't think the stars were literally singing. And the angels shouted for joy. It's either the stars were singing or the stars are referring to earth, spiritual powers like angels or something like that. So he's saying, where were you when this joyful process was going on? Creating was a joy for God. In those descriptions of wisdom in the book of Proverbs, where wisdom, which we see fulfilled in Christ, wisdom was the craftsman at the side of God the Father. And there was a joy in creation. There was a beauty in creation. It's a joy that we feel when we create as well. But coming back to the central point, God says, but where were you in that joyful process? Were you with the angels? Were you with me there? Were you at my side there? And of course, the answer is no. Verses 8 through 11, who is it that subdues the oceans? It pictures the sea as a baby bursting out of the womb and then wrapped up and subdued. And while I got distracted while I was reading through, because I was thinking about this week, we managed to get away this week to Cornwall for a few days, and there was very high winds in the southwest and massive waves, and probably more than the waves was massive slops of sea coming in, where you get two sort of waves combined. And there were people on the beach, particularly at Trebarwith, and if you're kind of old sweats like us, and you know what happens at Trebarwith, you know, two waves combine, and suddenly you've got like 50 metres more sea than you had before. And so there were people sitting on the beach, or standing on the beach mostly, because they were in Wellingtons and a bit shivery, but on the beach, and they were looking at this wave that was quite a long way back, and then suddenly there'd be some great surge, and this wave would come right, advance right up the beach, right up to the cliffs. And you're thinking, who can subdue something like that? You know, of course, engineers can build walls and defences and all those kind of things, and so we have, as people made in God's image, got some ability to subdue in some sense. But looking at the mass of all the waves in all the world, who can set the boundaries for them? And in fact, we set our boundaries and then they erode and bits of the land, fall into the sea, don't they? Because we can't subdue the waves. We can't mark out where they stop and start. It surrounds the whole of land on the earth. And God decided where it would begin and end. And it's God who tells them where to stop. It talks about the great clouds above the seas as well. And God knows all about them. Who knows where the clouds begin and end? Who starts and stops them? Where were you when I ordered day and night? Verses 12 through 15. I bring light into darkness. Have you done that? Verse 12. Have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place? Have you ever said, son, it's time to wake up? Like you might do to your children or somebody else in your household. Have you ever shook the sun and said, wake up, it's time for dawn? God says, you haven't done that. You haven't ordered day and night. Things take shape as like forms. That's why he talks about clay being molded. Like it's almost like the world is kind of formless because it's dark. And then the light comes and everything takes shape. And what he's saying there is more than just, I'm in charge of creation. Because it's interesting where he goes with it. Look at verse 15. The wicked are denied their light, and their upraised arm is broken. And you think, what's that got to do with light and darkness? God's obviously extending the point beyond I control the sun and the movement of the earth so the sun rises. I do more than that. I actually bring about light into dark places. I actually expose the darkness of the wicked. I actually, in the end, break the strength of the wicked. No one can stand against me. It's all ordered for my purposes, to bring me glory, to judge and to rule. Verses 16 through to 30. I know the sources for everything. I know where everything begins. Have you been to all those places, Job? Verses 16 through to 30. First of all, 16 to 18, depths of the sea. Vast creatures there. Yes, I know one of the more recent David Attenborough programs series, he went particularly in the depths of the ocean, the deepest places, places that people had never been. But God is going beyond that. He knows that people will find some of those places and can go there. But what God is saying is, can you simultaneously be present everywhere where everything begins? Do you know the source for everything? Do you know where the sea has its boundaries underneath? Do you know where storms come from? Do you know where snow comes from? Can you direct the paths of it? Are you ordering the whole of nature? Do you know where it all begins and ends? Are you setting boundaries for it? And when he talks about darkness, he goes on to talk about death. He talks about the darkness of the bottom of the ocean as kind of a place of death. Verse 17, have the gates of death been shown to you? And he's saying, it's more than just I understand creation and seas and skies and snow. I understand more than that. I understand behind that the source of everything and the source of life and the source of death and the place of death. Have you been to all those places? Do you know it all, Job? And of course, verse 21, we get a bit more irony. We love a bit of irony in the book of Job, don't we? Verse 21, surely you know, for you were already born, you have lived so many years. And God is probing Job and saying, you've got to realize your limitations. So 19 through to 21, he talks about light and darkness. And do you know where light comes from? And we may be able to go to the depths of the sea, but we can't go to the sun, can you? Can you travel in a spaceship to the sun? See where light is sourced? Could you go into a black hole? Nobody knows kind of what they are. Somebody sort of discovered and defined them, but you can't sort of put a boundary around them and say, you know, this is darkness, I understand it. Here's a scientific formula that will explain everything about it. And then verse 22 to 30, the snow and the lightning and the storms, as I mentioned already. And then verse 31 through to 41, can you control everything? Have you been the source of everything? And then can you control everything? Verse 31 through to 41, that we didn't read, but it talks about the stars, leading out the stars and putting them in place. And then verse 33, do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? Sometimes when we try and persuade people of the truth of the existence of God, we talk about maybe eight parameters, like eight dials in a control room somewhere, eight laws of nature, eight very important numbers. And if those numbers were out by just such a minuscule amount, life would not exist, planets would not exist, you would not exist. The laws of nature, we might call them, the laws behind the universe, the fundamental numbers that govern everything. And God says, do you know all of those? And more importantly, do you set them? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth, he says in verse 33. It's probably worth saying as well that, again, when he talks about stars, he may be using stars to talk about the literal stars in the solar system, but also to talk about how he controls rulers. Stars are often used to depict rulers of nations and empires. And he says, I lead them out like tame cubs. See that verse 32? Can you lead out the bear? It's one of the star formations. Can you lead it out like a tame cub, a cuddly cub, not a fierce lion? I control them. And the point is that God is able to control everything he provides. So what happened to you, Job, wasn't an accident. God goes on, chapter 39. Do you know everything? Do you know everything? First four verses, I see life from the beginning. Gives the example of a mountain goat. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you watch when the doe bears her fawn? Do you count the months till they bear? Do you know the time they give birth? And he's given an example of something that's wild, that's not necessarily seen. It's not a tame animal that perhaps they would know about the birth and the gestation period and all that stuff. Is gestation period the right thing? I don't know how long you're pregnant. All that stuff. You might know that about a tame animal, but he's talking about one out in the wild, a wild goat, or a reindeer, a deer out in the wild, and saying, do you know all the detail of that? It's happening in some place where no other person lives, and this birth is happening. And I see life from the beginning. From conception, I see life, says God. And particularly verse 5 through 12 talks about wild animals. When things get out of the control of men, who let the wild donkey go free? Who untied its ropes? And it's in the wasteland. And then verse 9, will the wild ox consent to serve you? Will it stay by your manger at night? Can you hold it to the furrow with a harness? Will it till the valleys behind you? So, and he gives the example then of a donkey and an ox. And says, okay, there are ones that you've tamed, there's ones that you control, but I'm in control of them even if they get out of your control. Situations in life that get out of your control, I'm still in control. Things that seem to run wild, I'm still in control. I still know where they are. They will not be tamed for you, but they are tame to me, says God. And then the ostrich, verse 13 through to 18, gives some details about how they lay their eggs. And they leave them exposed, it says. Some fascinating little nature details as we go through here. Great insight that God has into his creation, of course. And apparently they lay their eggs and they are in danger. And God almost sort of pokes fun at the ostrich at first. They sort of flap joyfully, though they're not quite as pretty as a stork. And they seem a bit stupid because they lay their eggs on the ground and they get warm in the sand and anyone could tread on them. But then God says, this seemingly foolish animal is like lightning fast. It flaps its wings. It seems a ridiculous animal. You know, ostriches just look a bit comical, don't they? And their eggs are slightly strange size in proportion to the body and all that kind of stuff. And they seem so stupid. And yet, in a moment, wham, they are so fast. They can beat the fastest horse. You know that. They flap their wings. They run. They're one of the fastest land animals. And so God's saying, what seems confusing, a confusing part of my creation, a part of my purpose in creation. See, I didn't make the ostrich really clever in all aspects of life, but I made it really fast, because that's what I do. Do you know everything? Do you know all that? Do you have the wisdom behind all that? Do you know why I'd made the ostrich like that? Do you know everything? Do you empower everything? Verses 20 through to 30. Verses 19 through to 25, we have the horse. I give the horse its strength, says God. Do you? Do you make it leap like a locust, striking terror with its proud snorting? This again is not talking domesticated horse so much, it's talking war horse. Not a sort of sweet pony, more a symbol of power. It's more like the nuclear weapons or the tanks of that day. It flies into battle. You see, it starts off kind of quite nice, you know, strength, its mane with a flow, its flowing mane and its strength. And you think, oh, no, sweet horse. And then as you get into the description, at the blast of trumpet, it snorts. It catches the scent of battle and the shout of commanders. Wham, it goes off. Not quite as fast as the ostrich, but it runs really fast, plunges itself into battle. It's a war horse. It's a tank. It's a nuclear weapon of its day, powering its way into battle. And God says, do you know, do you empower the horse? Do you give it its strength? Of course you don't, Job. And the last description, verse 26 through to 30. I set the flight path for the hawk. Do you? Sure, at one time or other, all of us have admired birds of prey. Heard descriptions of them, their amazing eyesight, that from a long way up, they can look down and see some little rat or weevil or whatever crawling around on the ground. And maybe not a rat, depends if you're an eagle or something, but some small animal on the ground. And their eyesight, that's why we talk about eagle eyes, don't we? But their eyesight can pierce right down and see. And then they tuck their wings in their body, don't they? And they shoot down, maybe 150 miles an hour, a bird of prey dives down in order to get its prey. Wham! And you imagine you're going 150 miles an hour. And I don't know when they start breaking. You know, about this height, 4 meters up. And they manage to come down and whoosh, grab their prey. Get their talons, is it called? The stuff they grab them with and grab hold of their prey. And it's pretty brutal. Again, it starts quite sweet. You know, you've got this hawk swaying around in the wind and it's soaring. And you think, oh, that's nice. And then verse 30, its young ones feast on blood, and where the slain are, there it is. And so again, God is just pounding you and Job with this message. I know all about creation. I use it for my purposes. And I'm in control of good and evil, of beautiful things, of brutal events, of things seemingly confusing and out of control. I am totally in control of all of those. So, verse 40 in the first couple of verses, chapter 40 in the first couple of verses. So, Job, are you really going to correct me? Verse 2, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? You've got to be joking. You're going to correct me? Let him who accuses God answer him. Answer all those questions, Job, and then maybe you might be qualified. If you could say yes to all of those questions, yes, I was there at the foundation. Yes, I know all the source of light and darkness. Yes, I give the strength and the flight path to the hawk and the strength to the horse, and I gave the wisdom to the ostrich, and I know about every birth in every place in the whole world, and I set the sea its boundaries. Yes, yes, I can do all that. Then just maybe you could answer God. But Job realizes the answer to every question is pretty much no. And so he says in verse 4, I'm unworthy. How can I reply? I put my hand over my mouth, expression of I need to stop speaking. I spoke once, but I have no answer twice, but I will say no more. Let's just draw some lessons out from that as we've done this. Fly past like the hawk. We've flown past the whole of these couple of chapters. And just a few lessons. I think you probably have seen them as we went through, but just to underline them. First lesson, God knows all his creation, and so he knows what is happening, and he knows what he's doing, and even in your suffering, he will provide for you. God knows all his creation. That's what God's saying. I know all about my creation, and so I know what's happening. And let's apply that directly to you, Job, in your suffering. I know what's happening to you. I know what I'm doing. And even in suffering, I will provide, because I don't just control the good bits. I don't just control the nice bits. I don't just control the hawk when it's soaring beautifully. I control the hawk when it's cowering down to the ground to grab its prey. I control the thunderstorms and the hailstorms and the snow. I control the light and the darkness. I know what I'm doing with good and evil. I overview the whole thing. So don't accuse me of not knowing what I'm doing. If you were there at the creation of the world, what tips might you have given God? What design ideas? Oh, I think you could do slightly better with that. To even say it out loud is just ridiculous, isn't it? To imagine that we would sit there with God saying, oh, I don't like that. But in a way, it's what we do sometimes with our circumstances. It's as though we say, you're the great creator, God, but I'm not quite sure what you're doing right now. God knows all of his creation, and he knows what he's doing. Second point, which builds from that, God is in charge of all events and uses good and evil for his purposes. He's in control of creation, so he orders all events and he knows what he's doing. But in particular, Job needed to hear that God uses good and evil for his purposes. And even in your suffering, Job, he will defeat evil. I think that's why it says there, and we'll see it more next week when Mark takes us through the next couple of chapters, where it talks about the wicked denied their light and the upraised arm is broken. God will bring light, but he does allow darkness. He does allow the places of darkness to exist, but he will eventually overcome all with light. In other words, he will eventually fully, completely break the powers of evil. He will defeat Satan, as we'll see next time. He knows what he's doing, and he uses all events for his good purposes and for his glory. And even in his suffering, even in your suffering this morning, he will defeat evil. Third thing. God asks the questions of you. You answer to him. He doesn't answer to you. It's one thing Job had to learn. Of course, he had to learn as well that God was doing good things, ultimately, for his glory, and that he would do right by Job. He needed to know that. But fundamentally, what he learns is, Job, I ask the questions, not you. That's not to say we should never inquire of God. It's not to say we should never search out God. It should never say, never that we could... I'll start that whole sentence wrong. It's not that we should never say, there's too many negatives in that, isn't it? It's all right to pray to God and say, what are you doing? It's all right to say that sometimes in prayer in exasperation. But ultimately, God does not answer to us. We answer to God. And it's such a revelation. It's such a transformation when we realize that. It's actually part of becoming a Christian, because before you become a Christian and you see it with people who you're trying to witness to, or you've got on evangelistic courses, or you're preaching to and chatting to, and you realize that at that point, they're asking the questions of God. Well, why did God allow this? And why did God do this? And why is the world like this? And can you explain this to me? And they're sitting over God and asking the questions and asking and saying, answer me, God. And actually, part of becoming a Christian is not that you get all the answers. Do you know what it is? It's part of the whole thing flipping, and you realize, oh, wow. It's God who asks the questions of me. Who am I? Who am I to you? What am I doing with this creation that you've given me? What am I doing with this revelation that you've given me? Who am I compared to you? It's God who asks the questions, and it's God who gives the answers too. You see, the most important thing, friends, whether you're in the room, whether you're listening online, is not what we think of God, although that is important in the end, but primarily, what matters is what God thinks of us, what God thinks of you. An author called John Blanchard a few years ago wrote a book with a really interesting title, Does God Believe in Atheists? That wasn't particularly a philosophical book kind of asking that question so much, because it went to go through lots of proofs for the existence of God. But it's a great turn of phrase, great question to ask, does God believe in atheists? Now, of course, God believes in atheists because atheists exist. But the point is that it's most important what God thinks, not what we think about God. It's a great turnaround of that common idea that it's all about persuading atheists to believe in God, when actually it's all about atheists turning to God and realizing that it's him who asks the question. And this morning, we all need to learn that we answer to God. He doesn't answer to us. He is right and good and faithful and reliable and secure. And he's so gracious because he tells us so much. But in the end, we answer to him. Last thing by way of drawing out some lessons. Fourth point. Only one man could answer yes to all of God's questions. And if you don't include that, you may be left this morning as just thinking, yes, I am rather pathetic compared to God. But actually, the gospel tells us that one man could answer yes to all of God's questions. Jesus answers God for us. It wasn't this man, Job, who could answer, but it was Christ. Christ is there joyfully at the Father's side in creation. Christ knows all the variety of nature, all the conceptions and births that are going on in all the world. Christ, in the end, commands the seas. He shows just a little glimpse of that, doesn't he, when he's on the boat with the disciples and he speaks and the whole waves and storm just stops instantly. Christ could answer yes to that question. Christ is the wisdom that laid the earth's foundations. Christ is the one that knows light and darkness. And Christ is the one who did get plunged into the depths, deeper than even Jonah when he's thrown off the boat and is swallowed up by the whale, deeper in depths than even that. Jesus plumbs the depths. He goes to the darkest place, literally at the bottom of the ocean, at the place of death. Jesus goes. Have you been there? You could say to Jesus, yes, I've been there. And so Christ ultimately answers on our behalf. So we do need to learn the lessons of humility. And we do need to learn that we can trust God even in our suffering. And we do need to learn that God has good purposes and he will bring about light in the end from darkness. But we fundamentally need to learn that because it's God who asks the questions, we need someone to answer for us. And it's Jesus who answers for you. If you trust in Jesus, if you know Jesus forgave your sin, if Jesus died for you on the cross as he plunged the depths of your disgrace there, then you know that it's Jesus who will bring you into the light. It's Jesus who hasn't broken you. He hasn't broken your upraised arm, but he's actually raised you up. And you can worship Jesus as the one who answers yes to all of God's questions.